Chapter 5 Sarnia Priest sighed gently. Save for her chin, her face was shadowed by the loose, fur-trimmed hood over her head, but in that shadow Nail could see a smile.
"I rather thought," he whispered, "that smiling was something you hadn't planned on doing out here, in Lucky Space."
"Dear Harlan," she muttered, "permit me a moment of nostalgic pleasure. It's been a long time. I'd forgotten the flavor of this place."
Nail hesitated. Whatever flavor the shipmistress was detecting was entirely lost on him. As far as he was concerned, Bonner's Reach smelled of promethium, dust, ozone leaking from the ancient void shields, spice musks and perfumes, and a general humid, noisome odor of air that had been through the atmosphere processes a few million times too many.
"I don't think I'm really quite getting its charms," he decided.
Priest rested a gloved hand on his arm.
"It has a certain character, Harlan, a robust vitality. You smell muggy filth. I breathe in vigor, zest, the aroma of a free trade station. I smell the frontier, the challenge of the beyond. I smell a truly neutral place where merchant venturers like myself can gather and do business away from imperial scrutiny."
She glanced round at her other companion, who flanked her to her left.
"No offense," she added.
"None taken," he replied. "When were you last here?"
"An age ago. Decades. But it hasn't changed. I'd forgotten it. I hadn't realized how much I'd missed it. Again, no offense."
"Again," said the other companion. "None taken."
They were moving along a stone jetty from the wharf towards the craggy bulk of Bonner's Reach. The jetty was sealed against the void by shimmering, intersected screen fields projecting between hoops of infinitely old technology that formed archways along the stone walk. 100 meters behind them, the great mass of the Hinterlight lay at grav anchor in the immense granite basin of a void dock. A series of mag baffles and air gates linked the merchantman to the end of the jetty. Nail had to admit that what Bonner's Reach lacked in olfactory sophistication, it more than made up for in visual impact. It had taken them 17 days to reach it from Flint, but the view alone was worth the trip. Bonner's Reach was an airless rock tightly orbiting a feeble, unstable star at the very end of its staggeringly vast lifespan. Long before man had begun to walk upright, someone had built a great stone bastion into the rock of its surface. Internal spaces in the bastion were chiseled down into the rock itself. No one could explain its origin or account for its manner of construction, nor even ascertain its age. Certainly no one could explain why its makers had abandoned the bastion and left not a shred of themselves behind. Early human venturers had found the place empty and open to hard vacuum. Effective installation of power plants, void shielding, and atmosphere processes had made it habitable, and it had remained so ever since. Because the Reach had no atmosphere, visiting starships, even those of great tonnage, could come in close and sit at low anchor above the lagoon, a vast crater bowl that had been scooped from the rock in front of the bastion. Alternatively, for a higher fee, they could berth in one of the many void docks and quays hewn into the mountainside out of which the bastion grew. The view from the jetty was uncompromisingly strange. Looking out through the crackling void fields that kept in the jetty's atmosphere, Nail could see the vast, blackened elevation of the bastion, seamless stone cut by a non-human hand. Lights, yellow and tiny, glowed at pinpricked windows. He could see ships, giant starships, floating out there in the darkness above the hard-shadowed white expanse of the lagoon. The crater was full of white dust, but it looked like a snowfield, a sea of unmarked snow, dotted like a snow leopard's pelt with the shadows of the starships anchored above it. Nearer at hand, bulk freight craft and other merchantmen lay sheathed in their void docks, umbilically linked to the bastion via the ghostly lit spurs of landing jetties. The sense of scale was terrifying. He was used to looking down on planets from afar, from orbit. Now he stood on the very threshold of one, and not even a large one, and could look around to see great frigates, clippers and sprint traders suckled against its embracing bulk. with a contrasting point of reference like the Hinterlight in view, Nail's mind balked a little at the dwarfing size of the world, and by extension, any world, and by further extension, the Imperium. And then, in turn, his tiny, inconsequential self. Patience Kiss strolled onto the Hinterlight's main bridge, her eyes on the principal display screen. It showed a view out across the lagoon as captured by the forward PICT systems. The bridge was quiet. Most of the primary crew stations had been vacated. Oliphant Twu, Priest's unnervingly reticent navigator, had been detached from his socket so he could enjoy a few hours' rest in his quarters after the lengthy voyage. Kiss was glad he was absent. Twu was always unfailingly polite and courteous to any passengers he encountered, but there was a loathsome aura about him that made most people uncomfortable and Kiss positively ill. It was the constant seething turmoil of his mind. It made her feel seasick. In its way, it was as bad as the blunter, Whiston Frauke. Frauke himself was present on the bridge, though his limiter was active. He had slumped in the second helmsman's throne, one leg swinging over the arm, smoking, as if it was his primary function in life. He nodded to Kiss as she came in, and his face curled into an expression that she realized with horror was probably his idea of an alluring smile. She ignored him. A trio of priest tech servitors was running standard overhauls on some of the tertiary system consoles on the far side of the bridge. She could hear the hiss and stutter of their gas-powered digits as they unscrewed retaining bolts. Hallstrom occupied the shipmistress's throne, maintaining an intent check on both the ship's engineering turnaround and external activity. He looked to Kiss very much the part of a shipmaster, confident and proud of his place. Priest so seldom left the Hinterlight herself, it was rare he got the opportunity to stand in. Thonius sat at the primary helm console to his left. He was flicking through hololith displays projected to his repeater screen from the main actuality sphere, manipulating the images with his good left hand, his right bound up in a sling. He seemed bored and preoccupied. A few meters in front of Frauke, Ravenna's chair sat locked to the deck by its mag clamps. The Inquisitor's unit seemed inert. Fat cables spooled out of the chair via opened access points in its surface armor and connected to four chunky portable units arranged around the chair on the deck. Psi booster units. More cables ran from the units to an open inspection hatch in the side of Thonius's console, linked directly to the Hinterlight's potent astrocommunication dishes. Kiss walked up to Hallstrom and perched her bottom on the edge of his console desk. "Mistress Priest doesn't approve of people sitting on the bridge stations," Hallstrom began.
"Oh, dear," said Kiss. "Is she on the bridge?"
"You know she's not," Hallstrom began.
"Then I'd say it was up to the acting master who sits where."
Hallstrom coloured slightly and then grinned. "Point, Mamsel Kiss. This is my watch for a change. You're fine where you are." She grinned back. She liked Hallstrom. Old school, reliable, kind of sexy too, if a girl had a mind to go for distinguished older males, which she never had. Not after Sameter.
"How are they doing?"
she asked. "They've left the air gate, heading down the jetty towards the station threshold."
"They're taking their frigging time about it," Thonius complained tersely.
Kiss looked over at Thonius.
"What's your problem? Got a hot date waiting?"
Frauke sniggered loudly. Hallstrom chuckled and made himself busy.
"Screw you, Kiss," Thonius said.
And so the banter begins, Kiss thought. Since they'd met, she and Carl Thonius had spent their time sparring. It was part of the team spirit, but, she considered, "screw you" lacked a great deal of the expected Thonius finesse. She slid off Hallstrom's console and crossed to Thonius's side.
"What's up?"
He shrugged and glanced up at her.
"Sorry," he said.
"Nothing to be sorry for. You're tense."
"I don't know why they're taking so long," he said.
He reached out with his left hand and methodically tapped out a control function that would normally have taken him an instant with both hands. The display image dissolved and changed. Now it showed an overview of the docking jetty through one of the Hinterlight's starboard PICT sources. There was the jetty, encased in its gleaming sleeve of void fields, stark against the blackness around and beneath it. She could see the landing party. priest, in full robes and finery, riding aboard an ornamental floater carriage that she controlled with an actuator wand in her right hand. Two bodyguards, tall, heavy-set men, walked with her, one on either side of the carriage. They were clad in long quilted coats and ornamental full-face helms, and each carried a long pole upright. The two poles supported a small canopy above priest's head. Behind them came a train of six cargo servitors, laden with caskets. The bodyguard at priest's right hand was Nail. The one to her left, nominally, was Zeph Mathuin. But to all intents and purposes, it was Ravenna. The Inquisitor was wearing Mathuin's body.
"They're just making a dramatic entrance," Kiss suggested. "You know them, mistress. She likes to arrive in style. Regally."
"Maybe," Thonius said.
Kiss leaned over and tapped a few keys, swinging the image around to show more of the bastion itself. Mysteries and rumours adhered to Bonner's Reach, as they did to all outlandish places. Some said the first venturers to come here found unimaginable treasures deep in the bastion's chambers. Others said there were still corridors and halls cut into the rock down there that no one had yet traced or followed. Many supposed that ancient and profoundly powerful Xenos technology, left behind by the builders of the place, had been found. One particular popular story had it that once in a while a visitor would go missing, lost forever after taking a wrong turn somewhere, or perhaps taken by the spirit of the place as a payment for continued human use of the structure. Every few minutes there was a brief flash or fizzle of light. These were photonic flare patterns, beginning to stutter out from the planet's old and dying star. At this early stage, these emissions were just precursor flashes. In 10 or 12 hours' time, they would have matured into a full-blown solar storm that would fill the sky with flame and last for 3 days. The storms happen every 35 months. That was firetide, when the ships put in at Bonner's Reach and their masters feasted and drank while the heavens blazed. Kiss sighed. Thonius's edginess was infectious.
"I don't know why we can't just march in and flash our warrants and—"
"Look out there, Mamsel Kiss," Hallstrom pointed, indicating the main display. "Look at the ships gathered there over the lagoon. I see rogue traders, far venturers, merchantmen of all sizes. And that? What's that? And that? And that over there, the disc-shaped vessel? That's 200 kilometers away, to give you some sense of scale. This is a frontier in both directions, Mademoiselle. A fair number of the visitors here have never heard of our authority. Those that have care less for it." "That's what free trade station means," Thonius said. "This is lucky space. Free space. A gateway. We Imperials are only tolerated visitors here."
"The stuff you know," Kiss mocked.
"You wouldn't believe," Thonius replied.
They were approaching the entry gate at the end of the jetty. Its ancient stone form was decorated with interwoven carved figures that symbolized leaping flame. Heaps of votive offerings were piled up either side of the gate pillars. Dolls, figurines, ritual pots, small tied-up sacks, drinking vessels, ribbons, occasionally an icon like an aquila, and those were simply the ones of human origin that Nail could identify. Any others were alien objects he could make no sense of. It was customary to leave a token offering at the gate on departure to vouchsafe one's next voyage. Two vigilants awaited them at the gate.
"You ready with a tribute?" Priest whispered.
"The servitors have been instructed," Ravenna replied through Mathuin's mouth.
The Order of Vigilance administered the reach. They collected tariffs, saw to the station's smooth running, and to the Congress of Fair Trade. The pair that now approached them were lean and tall, at least as tall as Harlan or Zeph. They walked with an easy, nimble step that told Nail right off they were consummate close fighters. Each vigilant wore a sleeveless antique gown of ribbed armour, marvellously constructed, baggy black pantaloons that were tight-cinched at the ankle, and black felt slippers that were shaped around the big toe. Their exposed arms were either bionic or encased in some form of skin plant technology. It was a tech design neither Nail nor Ravenna had ever seen before. Sheathed over their shoulders, they carried ceremonial hand-and-a-half swords. Their heads were bare and shaved. More of the curiously wrought skin-plant tech encased their necks, so that their heads seemed to be resting on slender columns of intricately inscribed metal. The skin of their faces and scalps was entirely covered in swirling flame tattoos, echoing the design around the doorway. Their eyes were augmetic implants that glowed a dull green.
"Welcome," said one.
Its voice was like silk.
"The Immaterium has brought you to Bonner's Reach,"
said the other, its tone rasping and deep.
"Free trade is welcome here,"
uttered the first. Perched on her hovering platform, Priest bowed.
"Thank you for your greeting and welcome," she said. "I most humbly crave admittance. I have brought a tribute for the welfare of all."
"Let us examine it," said the rasping one.
At a signal from Nail, the servitors brought forward the caskets and opened some of them. Foodstuffs, much of it stasis fresh, wine, and some flasks of Amasek.
"This is acceptable tribute," said the rasping vigilant.
"Welcome," repeated the silky one.
"Do you wish us to advertise your presence and identity to the merchants here?"
"I am shipmistress Ziedmund, of the sprint trader Tarnish. I am here for Firetide, but I also seek interest in commerce."
"Ziedmund, Tarnish,"
they echoed.
"I have serious collateral," she added. "Make that known. I am interested in genuine business."
"You appreciate the code of the Reach?"
asked the vigilant with the silk voice.
"Peace and discourse," Priest replied, "and no weapon within the bounds of the Reach with a range longer than a human arm."
Nail and Mathuin dutifully displayed the empty holsters at their hips, the ritual sign of unarmed intent.
"You are familiar with our rules?"
said the silky-voiced vigilant.
"You have been here before,"
the rasping one said. It was more of a statement than a question. Nail stiffened.
"I am a trader," said Priest. "I go where I please."
"Voice pattern records show you to be Sinia Priest, shipmistress, not Ziedmund."
"Traders change their identities. Is that a problem?"
"Not at all. We are ever discreet."
The vigilants stood aside and ushered them through the threshold.
"Enter and make your trade."
Beyond the gate, they entered a capacious chamber, hewn out of the planetary rock. The air was still muggy and overused. The place was bathed in a yellow, fulminous light from bioluminescent tank lamps mounted at regular intervals along the wall. Archways led off into other chambers, and at the far end, a well-lit tunnel disappeared away into the free trade areas. More vigilants appeared to conduct priest's servitors to the communal larders where the tribute could be left. One of them, his voice a whisper, approached the shipmistress.
"Do you require a guide, a translator, any other service?"
"I will ask if I need any such service," she said.
The vigilant bowed and backed away. With her bodyguards either side of her, Priest began to glide sedately down the long tunnel. On Bonner's Reach, visiting traders could avail themselves of drink and nourishment free of charge. Indeed, almost all services were free. A berthing fee was required, of course, but once that was paid, a trader could luxuriate in the bountiful hospitality of the station. The level of comfort was designed to relax visitors and encourage profitable, unhurried mercantile negotiation. The vigilants merely expected a fee equivalent to 1% of gross on any deal or transaction made within their precincts. Of course, this apparent largesse was helped enormously by the recognized custom of tribute. Every captain, master, or venturer, human or otherwise, was expected to offer something in the way of foodstuffs, liquor, or other intoxicants upon arrival. Priest's tribute was conducted down 3 kilometers of rock-cut corridors into a handling bay that adjoined one of the station's many food preparation areas. There the servitors set the caskets down, as instructed, and made their way back to the hinterlight. A vigilant labelled the caskets with storage instructions. Before long, kitchen labour would sort through the caskets and distribute the contents. Perishables into cold stores and stasis vaults, wine to cellars, dry goods to the well-stocked pantries, specialist foods into appropriate containers, and narcotics to the tenders who walk the floors of the free trade salons. The vigilant was called away. two potmen were having an altercation in the nearby kitchen. Priests' caskets were left unattended against the wet quartz wall of the handling bay. The lid of the fourth casket along popped open. Telescopic levers hissed taut, lifting the produce tray up, revealing it to be merely a shallow false top. Breathing deeply and slowly, Kara Swole slid herself out of the hidden cavity. She had contorted her body into a tiny space. As she emerged, she paused, grimacing, to pop her shoulder joints back into place. Kara looked around. There was no time to complete a full body recovery here. She reached her hands up and detached the fiber optic patch from over her left eye. The adhesive took some lashes with it. She rubbed her eye and wound the patch up in its long string of wire, unplugging the far end of it from the inside of the casket. Thanks to the fiber optic, she'd been able to see a cold light view of the outside and judge the best time for emergence accordingly. Keeping a watchful eye around her, Kara tucked the fiber optic into a hip pouch. She was wearing a skin-tight, light-reflective body glove with only her head exposed. Her thick red hair was slicked into a tight latex net that made her look bald. She opened the next casket along and removed its false top layer too. Her equipment was stowed beneath. First, a small pre-packed rucksack on a tight Phylon harness. Then, a compact Vox, and a multi-key that slipped neatly into holder loops on her waistband. Her limbs and back were sore. She stayed wary, expecting discovery at any moment. The thin combat knife slipped into place in her glove's calf sheath. Nearly done. She could hear footsteps approaching. One last task. Two almost empty tribute caskets would be more than a little suspicious. She tore open the shrink-wrapped packs of dehydrated kelp and shook their dry contents out into the bottom of each casket. Then she tore the top of a water flask and emptied its glugging contents after them. Footsteps came closer. She pushed the produce trays back into place, closed the casket lids, and dashed into the shadows at the far end of the handling bay. Then, like an arachnid, she went clear up the sheer quartz wall. The palms and soles of her body glove were angle-ribbed with razor-steel filament hooks that could find purchase on almost any surface. She reached the top of the wall, slid into a rocky cavity, and lay still. A troop of kitchen labourers wandered into the bay below her, flipping up the lids of priests' caskets to examine the fare. As she watched, they opened the casket where she had been concealed and took out the top tray. The rest of the casket was chock-full of glistening kelp. She heard the labourers scoff and moan. It was typical cheapskate rogue trader behaviour, come bearing plenty when in fact most of the make-weight was sea cabbage. Kara grinned to herself. As soon as the labourers began to heft the caskets out into the larders, Kara began to move again, scuttling across the rock wall and in under the great flinty arch to the kitchen. Her arms and legs were throbbing with pain. Sheer climbing put an enormous stress on musculature, and her body wasn't yet limber from the forced contortions of the casket. She forced herself on. A cramp in her left calf lost her some grip, but she clenched her teeth and persisted. The kitchen below her was a vast and dingy haze, steam surging up from a dozen canisters on a dozen stoves, smoke trailing off roast veal and orkunu and marinated cinqua on the fire pits. Drums of broiling kettlefish, pans of frying lardons, tureens of pottage, steamers of phoebe dumplings, and blanching wilt leaf. The roof of the chamber was a thick smog, which suited her just right. Though stone-cut, the kitchen hall was bolstered with thick cross-members of steel that formed ceiling beams. She dropped down onto the nearest one, swathed in oily smoke and vapour. There, invisible to the staff 20 meters below her, she stood for a long while, tension flexing and relaxing her tortured body. Arms, joints, digits, spine, ribs, pelvis. As if performing to some great invisible audience, she began to stretch and slide, backflip, rotate and split. Then she lay on her back on the beam, the kitchen clattering and broiling below her. She was still sore, that was inevitable after 2 hours in the box, but she was at last spry and warmed up. Kara Swole rolled over, rose and began to run across the beam towards the interior of the station. It was the worst dream yet. Something liquid yet solid was pouring in under Zael's habdor. It was black, and it was stinking. Like his granna's glue. Like a frigging mind-burning glue. He tried to wake Granna. She was asleep in her chair, snoring. When he shook her, his hands went into her flesh like it was rotten, fly-blown meat. Yelping out in revulsion, he backed away and grabbed his Granna's little effigy of the god emperor from the top of the cupboard. Zael held it out at the viscous horror, spurting in around the door cracks into the kitchen.
"Go away, Nove! Go away! Leave me alone!"
"Something he needs to know." He stifled a scream and woke up. Zael moaned and turned over in his cot. The cabin was dark, but he had left a light on in the bathroom. Its frosty glow spilled out across the gloomy space. He was breathing hard. He wanted to call for Nail or Kara or even Kiss, but he remembered they were engaged on some sort of mission. He wondered if he should try to contact the chair. Nail had advised him to, back at that place. What was it? Lenk? He hadn't. He hadn't dared. He still didn't really know what the chair had brought him along for, or why the chair considered him special. But he didn't want to spoil things. He didn't want to give the chair an excuse to ditch him. And what was this? Wasn't this excuse enough? Zael was having nightmares. His head was on wrong. After weeks, he was still witchy with come-down symptoms. Zael sat up in the dark. He pushed his pillow across his knees and then leaned his head into it. He wished, really wished, he could be a person like Nail, a sorted-out, in-control person. Or like Kara. Hell, even like Kiss or Thonius. Zael heard a sound from the bathroom, like a block of soap falling from the rack, or a rubber ball bouncing in the metal drain tray. How could a... He rose to his feet, holding the pillow in front of him like the most frigging pathetic shield in the Imperium. Water was hissing in the bathroom now. The shower head. Hot water. Steam gusted out of the cubicle, filming the glass door. There was someone in there, inside the shower cube. Someone fogged by steam and water. Zael swallowed hard.
"Hello? Zael?"
The voice echoed out over the rush of the shower. Zael heard someone spit out water to say the name.
"Yeah. Who's in there?"
"It's me, Zael."
"Who's me?"
"Frick's sake, Zael. Don't you know your own sister?"
Zael began to back away.
"My sister? She's dead. You're not my sister."
"Of course I am, little,"
said the misty figure behind the glass door.
"Why do you think I've been trying so hard to find you?"
"I don't know,"
Zael murmured.
"Everything's joined, little. Everything's linked. Space, time, souls, the God Emperor. It's all one big connected everything. You'll understand it when you're here with me."
"With you? What do you want, Nove?"
"I have to tell you something. Okay?"
"What?"
The shower shut off abruptly.
"Snatch me a towel, little. I'm coming out."
No! No, don't!
The stall door opened. His sister stood before him, fully dressed, soaking wet from the shower, haloed by steam. And as burst and broken as she had been when they'd found her at the foot of the habstack. Zael simply blacked out.
"Let's circulate," Sinia Priest suggested.
Her voice had a sly tone to it. She was enjoying this, and that pleased me. Bonner's Reach seemed to have reawakened Priest's enthusiasm for my hazardous occupation. For the first time in years, she was positive and engaged. Probably because at last she had a proactive part to play. We were standing in the stone entrance arch of one of the principal free trade salons. The scale of the chamber impressed me. It was bigger than the Carnivora, bigger than the interiors of some ecclesiarchy temples I'd seen. A monstrous chamber hollowed from the planet's rock, lit by huge biolumen tank lights suspended in clusters from the faraway roof. The other end of the chamber was so far away, I could barely see it, even through Zeph Mathwin's enhanced optics. A flight of marble stairs led down from the archway into the floor of the salon. Below us, hundreds, thousands, perhaps, of figures were gathered informally, drinking, talking, discoursing, trading. On our level, side galleries swept away around the walls of the hall. Looking up, I saw further tiers of galleries, 20 or more, circling the chamber all the way up to the ceiling. The side galleries, enjoying a view over the salon's main floor, were for private negotiations. There were booths spaced regularly around their circuits, softly lit, where traders dined together, gamed, and indulged. A quick muster of my mind, boosted as it was by the amplifiers on the Hinterlights Bridge, told me some various booths were vox-screened, some picked opaque, and most of them were psi-shielded. A trader entering a booth could activate discretionary barriers to keep his commerce private. We went down the steps into the throng. Priest hovered her way down like some monarch on her archaic floater carriage. It was a business to keep the canopy decorously unfurled above her. I switched my mind from side to side, like a broom, sweeping up scraps of detail from the scene. Priest was in her element, confident, happy in a way that surprised even her. Nail was tense. A passing taste of his mind told me he didn't like it. I could hear a repeating mantra circling in his thoughts.
Way too exposed. Too many angles. No cover. Way too exposed.
It'll be fine. He glanced at me. His expression was hidden by the visor of his blast helm. I glimpsed his eyes.
Very well, he said, reluctantly.
What's the trouble?
Nothing, boss. Nothing.
We proceeded onto the floor of the salon. I took a selfish moment to enjoy this brief stint of physicality. I relished the body I was wearing, its power, its strength, its mobility. Zeph was almost too easy to wear, one of the key reasons I had employed him. Wearing others was often traumatic to both me and them, but Zeph Mathwin gave up his corporeal form without any negative resistance. I borrowed his flesh like a man might borrow another's coat. When the time came for us to change back, neither of us ever suffered any consequences more serious than fatigue. On we moved, through the jostling, chattering floor space of the salon. On every side, rogue traders chatted and bartered with others of their kind. Bodyguard carders sat around low tables, getting drunk while they waited for their masters and mistresses to finish socializing. Races mixed. I saw Eldar, of a craft world unknown to me, resplendent in polished white armor, engaged with a fat human ox in furs, riding on a lifter throne. Neculi hunched and chattered around a trio of methane breathers who were tanked inside bizarre viro-armors that glistened like silver and exuded noxious odors. A bounty hunter in full body plate strode past us, trailed by his servitor drones. To my left, a Kroot cackled and barked. To my right, a trader whose body was entirely augmetic chortled a mechanical chortle as the shapeless fang he was dealing with cracked a joke. The trader was exquisite. His body parts and face were machined from gold, his dental ivory set perfectly in gilded gums, his eyes real and organic. Some abominable form of opal-shelled mollusk hovered on a lifter dais and fluttered its eye-stalks and elongated mandibles at a rogue trader in a red blast coat. As we went by, I saw that the rogue trader was human except for his transplanted feline eyes. Something humanoid but not human, an elongated figure in a white vac suit, its skin blue, its neck serpentine, blinked its large mirror eyes at a monthropod and its larvae. The monthropod and its kin curved their tube forms backwards and clattered their mouthparts to pay homage. Four Parsi drifters in gowns embroidered with stellar charts examined the product examples of Jacaro technology. A human trader with mauve skin dye studied an outworld prospector's gem samples through a jeweler's lens. I saw guildsmen among the rabble. The Imperial merchant guilds were supposed to limit their activities to inter-imperium commerce, but it was well known they had no desire to see the potentially vast profits of the outworld markets go only to the free venturers and rogues. Everywhere, tenders went to and fro. Some were girls, some boys, many were xenoforms. They scurried to serve drinks and provide other diversions. Priest held out a hand and stopped one, a handsome, hairless youth.
"What is your pleasure, mistress?" he asked. "I have some of glad and some of grin, and also fine sniff musk."
3 amasecs," priest said. "Make them all doubles."
The tender scooted off. Several merchants made formal approaches to priest, but she politely expressed disinterest to each after a few words had been exchanged. One, however, was especially persistent. He was a mutant, or a hybrid, unnaturally short and wide, a dwarf by human standards. His hair flew back behind him in a great crest. His thick chin sported a shaved back goatee. He was dressed in a dark red body glove, armored with suspended metal plates. His bodyguard, a single, unimpressive Elquon manhound with dejected eyes and heavy, drooping jowls, accompanied him. Approaching priest, he turned her a deft bow.
"Do I have the habit of acquainting ship Mistress Siegmund?" he said.
Though he was making an effort to affect a tone of high-born class, he could not disguise the common twang in his voice, nor the fact that low Gothic was not his native tongue.
"I am Siegmund," said priest. "I am most audible to meet you," said the little master.
I tried to scan him, but realized he was wearing some type of blocker.
"Mistress, what say we chivy us up some appendable tenders, attire ourselves some disgustable comestibles, and revive to a private pool for interculation?"
Priest smiled at him.
"Why would we do that?"
"It has been brought to my apprehension by the vigilance that you are in the marketplace, so to speak, for suggestive retail propositioning. In that rearguard, I am your man."
"Really?" priest said. "Who are you?"
"Milady, mademoiselle, I am Sholto Unworth. Do not be deceived by my diminutive stature. I may not stand tall, but I cast, so to speak, a long shadow. And that shadow is entirely made up of trade."
He said the last with emphasis, as if we should be struck with wonder at his pitch. We were, though it's fair to say, not for the reasons he hoped. "Do you want me to get rid of him?" I heard Nail whisper to priest. Unworth heard him too. He held up a hand, the chunky fingers splayed.
"Now, now, there's no need for musculature."
Nail glared at him. Unworth tugged his own earlobe.
"I miss nothing, Eveswise. Ears as sharp as pencils, me. No, no, all fair. If Mistress Siegmund here finds me an abject increment in her affiliations, and wants no more of me, all she has to overtake is a word in my general. A simple ingratitude from her, and I will be, so to speak, out of your air. Without any requisite for shoving, slapping, or harsh language. On the however hand, if what I have so far expleted trickles her fancy, I would be most oblate to dispel some more at her total inconvenience on the subject of what I have pertaining in my cargo hold."
"A moment, Master Unworth,"
priest said.
"By all means have a sundry of them,"
he said. Priest turned to Nail and me.
"He's just the thing. Trust me on this. I know how places like this are. Can't you just smell the desperation? He's so hungry for trade. His tongue's going to be a lot looser than most around here."
"It's your call," I said.
"Just hang around and look bored," priest said.
"Not a problem," Nail growled.
"Master Unworth," priest announced, turning back to face him. "I would be delighted to discuss potential trade opportunities with you."
He looked stunned for a moment.
"Really?"
he mouthed. Even his manhound temporarily lost its dejected expression. Unworth recovered fast.
"Well, I'm ensconced by your cordium. It quite inflates me. Let us revive at once to a booth and digress in private."
He became quite animated, leading us through the crowd and up one of the marble staircases to the first gallery. As he went, he summoned tenders and made a great show of ordering up a handsome dinner. We followed. As it turned to fall into step with us, the manhound gave me a long-suffering shrug that quite warmed me to it. Unworth found a free booth and pulled himself up onto one of the seats. Priest stepped down off her carriage and sat opposite him. Already, tenders were arriving with trays of sweetmeats, savouries, and drinks. The manhound went to sit down beside its master, but Unworth glanced at it sharply and hissed,
"Not on the furniture, Fifelank!"
Rebuked, it curled up on the floor outside the booth and began to scratch its neck lugubriously with a hind claw, causing a slapping ripple to travel up its overhanging jowls. One of them, Unworth or Priest, activated a picked opaque field, and Nail and I were left outside to guard the carriage. We leaned the canopy poles against the wall. The manhound looked at us, then settled its chin on its paws and began to doze. I followed Harlan to the gallery rail, and we looked out across the salon.
"This is taking a long time," he said. "I never expected this to be quick," I replied, "or easy. I have faith in Sinia. We take her skills as a pilot for granted. It's about time we made use of her skills as a trader." "Maybe." "Kara okay?" "Yes, I can sense her. She's in and moving." "That's something." He was about to say something else when there was a sudden commotion on the salon floor below us. The manhound raised its head sleepily. Nail and I straightened up from the rail for a clearer view. A fight had broken out. The crowds of merchants drew back to give it room, peering at the action. In a few scant seconds, vigilance had appeared, swords drawn, and formed a cordon around the fracas. I expected them to stop it, but they didn't. They simply kept the crowds at bay. It seemed that any physical dispute was allowed to find its own resolution, provided those involved stuck to the station rules about weapons. There were four combatants, a slender human trader with a mane of frizzy white hair, dressed in a long, grey blast coat, his two skin-gloved bodyguards, and a big brute wearing carapace armour that looked as if it had been made from mother-of-pearl. The armoured man was bareheaded. He had a stripe of bleached hair running across his scalp, and his face was threaded with old scars. His nose and ears were just nubs of gristle. He was swinging a power maul in his left hand. The trader, screaming out to the crowd and the vigilance for sympathy and help, was trying to stay out of the actual clash. His binders had drawn short swords and wore buckler shields on their left wrists. The armoured brute took one out almost at once, leaving the man twitching on the deck, his body crackling with dissipating electrical charge. The onlookers clapped and whistled. The other bodyguard flashed in, stabbing with his sword and deflecting the maul with his buckler. The sword made no dent whatsoever on the pearl armour. Ducking under a final desperate stab, the armoured man swung the maul in hard and connected with the minder's face. The minder slammed backwards, turning an almost complete backflip. He was dead, of that I was certain. The electrical charge of the maul was enough to incapacitate, but the physical blow alone had crushed his skull. More approval from the crowd. His bodyguard down, the trader turned and tried to flee. The vigilance pushed him back into the open. As the armoured man came charging towards him, uttering a bellicose yell, the trader frantically reached into his blast coat and pulled a revolver. One of the vigilants turned and broke from the cordon with stunning speed. His sword whistled down in an elegant slice and severed the trader's hand at the wrist. Hand and gun hit the deck and bounced. A half-second later, the power maul had laid the trader out. Holstering his maul in a leather boot across his back, the armoured man grabbed the trader's convulsing, sparking body and held it up with one hand, the frizzy white hair pulled back to reveal the man's face to the crowd. With his other hand, the armoured man raised a warrant slate that displayed a hololithic picture of the trader's face. The crowd began to boo and jeer, returning to their business. The cordon broke up, and the vigilance gathered up the fallen bodies. "Bounty hunter," Nail said.
"Yeah?"
"You saw him flash the warrant. This place is crawling with hunters. They're looking for absconders and evaders. My guess is they locate them here, and then either pick them up once they leave, or, if they're bold, like Warner there, take them down in public."
"You know him?" I asked.
It was a silly question. Nail had been a bounty man himself for many years. He knew the industry and its more notable players. "Lucius Warner, of course. Been in the game 15 decades. Piece of shit."
"And there are others around?"
"Everywhere. We've been scanned at least 6 times since we came in. Hunters check everyone out. They never know who they might run into in a place like this. I was alarmed. I hadn't noticed. Wearing a body like Mathuin, I expended a lot of my power simply controlling the form. It deprived me of the full scope of abilities I enjoyed in person. Suddenly, I felt vulnerable. I understood Nail's worried state. This was a dangerous place.
The solar flashes were coming in so frequently now that Hallstrom had dimmed the bridge screen resolution. He remained seated in the mistress's throne, running and rerunning diagnostic checks on the main console display to take his mind off the wait. Ravenna's chair was just a silent shape, immobile. Thonius had crossed to Frauke, and the two men were playing virtual regicide on a hololith repeater. Kiss watched them. Thonius accepted another of Frauke's low sticks, and they carried on, smoking, playing, chatting quietly. Frustrated, Kiss paced up and down the main aisle of the bridge between the consoles for a while. She was so bored, she even stepped into the vacant navigator's socket to try it out for comfort.
"Please don't do that," Hallstrom called.
Kiss looked at him. "Even on my watch, Tu is very particular about his socket." Kiss sniffed and got out.
"Aren't we all?"
She wandered back to Hallstrom.
"You're bored," he observed.
"No. Oh, all right, yes. But edgy, too."
"I know what you mean," Hallstrom smiled.
Almost involuntarily, he flicked up another screen display.
"See that?"
"Uh-huh," she said. "What is it?"
"Haven't the faintest," he replied. "Just a bunch of figures and runes. I keep punching it up, looking at it, but no idea what it means."
She looked at him.
"You're joking."
Hallstrom grinned. "Of course I am. It's the atmosphere post-process chart. But the point is made. I'm just filling time."
"Is it always like this?"
"What?"
"Work. Your work. As a throne agent. I thought it would be exciting. Cloak and dagger stuff. We don't get to sample it much, us and the crew. You're down on planets doing who knows what. We're up at anchor, waiting. I got quite excited when the Inquisitor said we were going out hunting in Lucky Space. But it's not really what I imagined."
"Believe me, it often goes this way," Kiss said. "Waiting, watching, getting jangly with nerves. Sometimes I think boredom is a more serious threat to us than heresy."
Hallstrom chuckled. "You must have devised coping strategies by now."
"Must we?"
"Of course."
"You're the ones who do the waiting usually," Kiss reminded him. "What do you do?"
Hallstrom waved his hand at the console display.
"This, mostly."
She sat on the arm of his throne. Behind them, Frauke won another game, and he and Thonius celebrated by lighting another pair of low sticks. Kiss looked back at Hallstrom.
"What else do you do?" she asked.
"We talk," he replied. "Reminisce. Priest is good at that. Her stories are wonderful. Have you heard any?"
"No. I don't know her very well at all."
"Magnus, the second helmsman, he's good value too. I get all my jokes from him. We talk about our lives and where we come from and so forth."
"And it passes the time?"
"Passes it fairly."
"We could try that, Mademoiselle Kiss. I know nothing about you."
"I know nothing about you, Mr. Hallstrom."
He sat up.
"Mutual ignorance. I think that sounds like a grand place to start. You first. Where were you born?"
"Sameter, in the Helican sub."
"Ah, dingy Sameter. I know it well."
"You?"
Hallstrom shrugged.
"My family comes from Hesperus, but I was born on Anuthis."
"That's a long way away. In the Sabbat worlds."
"Indeed. We travelled a lot. My father was in the fleet, and I followed after him."
Kiss leaned back.
"Into service, you mean? You were a captain once, weren't you?"
"Yes," he said. Absently, he switched the display to another diagnostic graphic. "But it's my turn to ask. Is that your real name?"
Kiss shook her head.
"It's my trophy name."
"What does that mean?" asked Hallstrom.
"I thought we were taking it in turns."
"This is still my turn. What's a trophy name?"
"It's one you get given when you're a trophy." "Terror, Mr. Hallstrom. You think Patience Kiss is a genuine name?"
"I did wonder. It sounded rather, how could I put it?"
"Ridiculous?"
"No, no. I was shooting for theatrical."
Kiss laughed.
My sisters and I were all given names. It was part of the game.
Hallstrom turned in his seat to look straight at her.
Game? I get the impression from your tone that this game was far from pleasant. It may be something you don't wish to talk about.
Correct.
But still, he shrugged,
if it's a name that you were given against your will, why would you keep it?
Why don't you go back to your original name?
Kiss thought before she answered. Her face went serious.
Because it keeps me sane to remember where I've been. And I made a promise a long time ago that the name wouldn't be forgotten.
Oh, Hallstrom said.
I think that makes it my turn, Kiss said. Why aren't you a fleet captain anymore?
Hallstrom sat back and closed his eyes.
I think your ground rules establish that there are some things we don't wish to talk about.
No fair, Kiss said, slapping him harmlessly on the arm. You can't dodge the question.
They're pretty, Hallstrom said.
Are they a recent acquisition? He was pointing at the glittering fish scales looped over her throat stud.
Thank you. Yes, they are. I picked them up on Flint. But you're avoiding my question again.
I know, he began. I don't like to talk about...
Hallstrom broke off. There had been a quick, choppy blurt on the ship's intervox. Suddenly sharp, he leaned forward.
What was that?
You tell me, Kiss said, rising to her feet.
Frauke and Thonius were still playing their game. Another blurt came across the speakers, a scared voice, indecipherable, cut up by the intercom channel, switching on and off.
What the hell? Hallstrom muttered.
Where's it coming from? Kiss asked.
Just checking, said Hallstrom, running his fingers over the keys. Another blurt sounded, a frantic scratching and a low moan, broken by the switching click of the system.
Someone's trying to use the intervox, fumbling with it, Kiss reasoned.
I've got the source, Hallstrom told her. Cabin 815.
Zale, she sighed. I bet that little freak is having another nightmare.
We should, Hallstrom started to say,
but Kiss was already striding away towards the hatch.
Relax, she called over her shoulder. I've got it.
Damn.
What's the matter, Harlan? Ravenna asked. Nail backed up from the rail, looking round.
What?
Ravenna asked again from Mathewin's mouth.
We're being scanned again, Nail said. I think someone's taken an interest.
Behind them, the picked opaque field dropped, and Priest emerged. The manhound looked up at her as she strode past.
Anything useful?
Ravenna asked her.
Indeed. Let's move.
Priest stepped up into her carriage and started sliding it forward. Ravenna and Nail took up the canopy poles and muddled it into position. As they moved away along the gallery, Unworth appeared from the booth.
Mistress,
he called out after them.
Mistress, are you accomplished that no exhilarated trade may partake between us? Mistress, I am most heartless in my disabusement.
Ignore him, Priest said.
Fine, Nail said. I could even kill him if that would help.
No need, she whispered.
They moved down the stairs into the throng of the salon floor.
Master Unworth has been most useful.
Go on, Ravenna said.
The October country is here. Unworth has been pestering everyone and tried it on with Thekla earlier today. Attempted to get Thekla interested in the useless gewgaws in Unworth's cargo. Thekla gave him the brush off. See, I told you a dunce like Unworth would be useful.
I'm impressed. What else? Ravenna asked, keeping his voice low.
I asked him about Flects, of course. Unworth went coy. It's way out of his league. But he knew the basics. The cartel meets in the second salon. That's through here. And the man to speak to, according to Unworth, is a merchant called Akunin.
Akunin? Anything else?
Priest paused and looked round at Mathewin's face.
You seem to want the world from me, Gideon. Haven't I just done terribly well?
You have, Sinia, and I'm grateful. But we don't know anything about this Akunin. Agents of the throne can't just march up to people and demand to be cut into the Fleck trade.
No, they can't, Priest admitted, but rogue traders can.
You've got the currency orders, Harlan?
Inside my glove, mistress, Nail said.
Well, unbutton and make ready. We're about to do business.
The door of Zale's cabin was shut, but not locked. Kiss slid it open and looked into the dark.
Zale? Zale, you freak? What are you playing at?
She heard a moan from over by the shower closet.
Zale, are you all right?
Another soft moan. Kiss stepped inside the cabin and reached for the lights. She pressed the activator, but nothing happened. Were they broken? Blown? Kiss advanced into the darkness, her eyes adjusting. She could hear sobbing. The air was warm and damp.
Zale, where in the name of Frigg are you?
Something moved in the gloom at the sound of her voice. She flinched, but it was just a body coiled on the floor. Kiss reached down and found Zale. His breathing was fast and shallow. From the smell of it, he'd wet himself.
Zale, it's me. It's Patience, get up.
Zale just twitched.
Come on, you Frigga. We have to get you cleaned up.
She picked him up and steered him towards the shower stall. Zale began to scream and thrash. Kiss slammed his quaking form up against the wall and held it in place.
What's the matter with you?
Don't make me go in the shower. She's in there. She's in there. She's all bloody and broken.
Who is? Zale. What are you talking about?
Nove.
Who the frig is that?
My sister.
You told me your sister was dead, Kiss said.
She is, Zale wept. Go in there and see for yourself.
Kiss let him slump. She walked towards the shower stall. The only light in the cabin was welling out from behind the glass. Kiss realized she had no weapon on her at the same moment she realized there was no reason for her to be armed. The boy had suffered a nightmare. That was the end of it. Why was her heart beating so fast? Why was she so scared? The fish scales. She thought of them at the very last minute. They were sharp, easy to TK. Mr. Hallstrom had admired them. She mind-lifted them off her throat stud and hovered them in the air. This was stupid. The boy had been dreaming. There was nothing in the stall. She took hold of the door handle. The scales were circling in the air. She opened the door. Inside the shower stall was nothing. Kiss sagged and breathed out. The scales flew back to her throat and fastened themselves again around the top stud.
Shit, Zale. You nearly had me there. I really thought...
She looked round and saw the boy was crawling towards the open cabin door. She bounded across to him and grabbed him by the hair. He squealed.
Listen, you actually scared me then with your game.
It wasn't a game, Zale whined. It was a message.
They entered the second salon. It was as busy as the first. At a question from Priest, a vigilant pointed them up towards a booth on the third gallery. They climbed the stairs. Almost at once, it was obvious the third gallery was quiet, almost empty.
I don't like it,
Nail whispered.
Oh, do shut up, Priest said.
The booths they were passing were vacant, as if they had been cleared. A tender hurried past.
Akunin?
Priest called out.
Where do I find Master Akunin?
Gone,
the tender cried, and in another moment so was she.
I think it's time to split, Nail said.
Agreed,
Ravenna said.
While we still can.
Two figures stepped out of a booth ahead and blocked the gallery. One was a Neculi, armed with a traditional saw-toothed lance. The other was a human in head-to-toe battle plate, polished a deep, silvery blue. He had a falchion in his right hand.
About face,
Ravenna hissed. They turned. Three more figures stood behind them. One was a man of heavy build with sandy white hair. To his left stood a croot with a billhook. To his right, a man in checkered leather armor, wielding a boarding axe. The man with the sandy white hair was wearing the camo armor of a game agent and held a huntsman's hooksword. He looked familiar, very familiar, to Nail. For a second, Nail thought it was Fever Sko. But this wasn't the man Nail had seen in the cave of the Carnivora. Nail had a good eye for faces. This man was a brother, or close kin. A dynasty of Xeno-hunters. That's how the Skos had been described.
What is this? Asked Priest.
Ravenna could hear the tremor in her voice.
The game agent smiled. This is the end of the line.
At the far end of the gallery behind the game agent and his comrades, Ravenna could see vigilance gathering, forming a cordon. No one was going to intercede on their behalf. As far as the Order of Vigilance was concerned, this was private business, and would be concluded privately, as per the weapon laws of the Reach. Go! At the single word, Nail and Ravener stroke Mathuin began to move. Mistress Priest's aristocratic canopy went clattering over as they upended it and drew the weapons concealed within its hollow poles. Stave swords, with hand grips as long as their thin, straight blades, slithered out into their hands. Nail went straight for the game agent, who bellowed and lunged to meet him. Stave blade encountered hook sword with enough leverage to send the hunter stumbling sideways. But the man in checkered armor and the croot were right behind their boss. Nail dummied left out of the swooping downward path of the boarding axe and smacked the pommel of the stave sword sideways into the side of the man's head. He cried out and fell down on one knee. Then a scything blow from the croot's billhook ripped a chunk out of Nail's quilted coat. The coat was lined with wire mail, and severed metal loops and scads of downy quilting shredded into the air. Nail leapt backwards out of range of the croot's next swing, doubled round to slam-kick the checkered fighter in the face before he could get to his feet again, and came up facing both the croot and the recovered game agent as they rushed him together. Ravener moved the other way, taking on the Neculi and the bounty hunter in the polished blue battle plate. Ravener's stave sword parried three vicious strikes from the man's falchion, two off the blade and one off the hand-grip base. The Neculi tried to flank him while he was occupied, but Ravener broke to his left, swinging the stave sword round in a two-handed overhead slice that described an arc of almost 360 degrees. The Neculi staggered back, wobbled, and collapsed. His throat slit. With a furious exclamation, the man in plate charged in, hacking with his sword. His skill and speed were both considerable. Ravener parried and deflected the rain of blows with a fluid, switching combination of single and double-handed grips, rotating the stave sword like a quarterstaff. Nail had never tangled with a croot before, though he'd had sight of them often enough to know what one was. Rumor said they were a mercenary race or a slave kind, serving some technologically advanced species beyond the imperial fringes, a species that only a few rogue traders had ever encountered. Despite its size, it towered over him, and its odd, jerky movements, it was formidably fast and seemed to possess unerringly acute senses. With its crude billhook, it managed to smash aside every clean stroke he made against it. It stank terribly of musky, rancid sweat. It would have been match enough for him, but he still had the game agent circling in from the right. The croot landed another rending blow that ripped into Nail's armor coat. He staggered backwards, wrong-footed, and the game agent slammed in, his hook sword striking across the side of Nail's helmet. Nail went sprawling. His buckled helmet bounced off his head across the gallery floor. "Harlan!" Priest yelled. The mistress was no fighter. She was caught, petrified on her carriage, between the two melees. The croot pounced forward onto Nail and chopped his billhook down. Nail rolled, leaving the tatters of his coat behind, pinned to the gallery deck. He leapt to his feet in time to meet and block the game agent's sword, turning its blade aside with his blade and bringing the end of the long hand grip round and up hard into the agent's face. Bone broke, blood spurted, and the agent tumbled backwards with a raging curse. But the croot was surging in at Nail from behind. "Nail! Nail!" Priest screamed exasperatedly. She jumped off her ornate carriage and aimed the actuator wand at it. It moved away from stationary with a rapid acceleration, hurtling forward half a meter off the floor. Nail began to turn at the sound of Priest's voice. He was stripped down to his body glove, and that would not withstand a direct hack from the croot's razor-sharp weapon. The unmanned lifter carriage, traveling at nearly 30 kilometers an hour, struck the croot from behind and bowled him over. He tumbled awkwardly, emitting a strangled squawk, and went sprawling. Nail came in, plunging his stave sword down, blade first, and impaled the thrashing avian to the gallery floor. The croot went into death spasms, beak clacking and bony limbs beating the ground. The violent motion ripped the stave sword out of Nail's hands. The man in checkered armor, his face a mask of gore, was back on his feet. He hurled himself at Nail. The man had lost his boarding axe. His hands clenched around Nail's throat. Nail rolled expertly with the force of impact, going down on his back and propelling the man right over him with his legs. The man crashed over into the nearest booth, destroying the meeting table under his weight. Nail was back on his feet in a moment, but now he was unarmed. The game agent came towards him, chopping with his hook sword. Nail could do nothing except dance out of the way of each swing. Behind him, Priest was still shouting, and Ravener was trading blow for blow with the battle-plated hunter. He'd been in worse positions, Nail thought, but right then he couldn't bring a single one to mind. Kiss dragged Zale out into the companionway.
"What do you mean, a message? What's the frigging matter with you?" she snapped.
He murmured something.
"What?"
Zale murmured again.
"I can't hear you. What did you say?"
Zale looked up at her. Blood was dribbling from his nostrils. Kiss couldn't remember hitting him. Why was his nose bleeding?
"Nove."
Wary for a moment, and suddenly terribly calm, she pulled him to his feet.
"Nove is your sister." "I'm not your sister."
"I know. She came. She told me."
"Told you what?"
Kiss asked.
"It's a trap,"
he said.
"It's a trap."
"Oh, God, Emperor," said Hallstrom abruptly. His tone was enough to make both Thonius and Frauke look up from their latest game. "What?" Thonius asked tersely. Hallstrom began punching the keyboard rapidly. "Something's wrong. I've lost contact with the mistress's landing party." Thonius got to his feet. Frauke lit another low stick. "Bad transmission," the blunter said, carelessly. "No, no," said Hallstrom. "We're being blocked."
"Are you sure?"
Thonius said, leaning in over Hallstrom's shoulder. "No, I'm not," Hallstrom said. He depressed another few keys. Nothing happened. "Bridge controls just went offline," he said.
"That's impossible," Thonius cried.
He was nursing his bound-up limb with his free hand, as if it was suddenly giving him pain. "You've made a mistake."
"I assure you, interrogator, I have not,"
Hallstrom began.
"Primary controls are locked out. The entire system is..."
"Who the hell's that?" Thonius said sharply. He was looking at the hololith displays that showed the feeds from the Pict sources overlooking the jetty. A dozen figures were marching down the jetty towards the Hinterlight's air gate. They were uniformly tall and hidden under hooded stormcoats. Four of them were paired off to share the burden of two long and clearly heavy pannier crates.
"Seal the air gate," Thonius hissed. "I can't," Hallstrom replied. "We're locked out."
The main hatch onto the bridge rattled open behind them. Madsen strode on deck, escorted by her two ministry colleagues.
"What is going on?" she asked.
Hallstrom began to rise from his throne.
"Mamsel Madsen, you're not permitted up here," he began.
"Oh, that's right," she said.
Her arm came up, and a snub-nosed automatic pistol was suddenly aiming directly at Hallstrom's forehead.
"Sit,"
she ordered. Thonius tried to run. A henobarb wheeled around and landed a monstrous punch that sent Thonius tumbling across the deck.
"Oh, f—"
started Frauke, dropping his low stick. Madsen turned casually and shot him. The raw boom of the gunshot made Hallstrom flinch. Frauke looked down in surprise at the bloodstains soaking out across his shirt, and then toppled backwards over the arm of his seat. Kinski, his face a malicious grin, walked up to Hallstrom.
"Sit," she said,
he laughed. Hallstrom sat, feeling his legs going weak.
"You can't do this,"
he mumbled. A henobarb was carrying a kit bag over his shoulder. He dropped it to the deck, unfastened it, and pulled out a metal object that looked for all the world like a limpet mine. He twisted the setting dial, and a red indicator light began to wink on its surface. It was a psionic nullifier unit, extremely high-powered, with a mag clamp built into its base. A henobarb strode over to Ravener's chair, slammed the device down onto its sleek casing, and locked it into place.
Priest was still shouting. "Give it a rest, woman,"
Nail thought.
"It's not doing any good."
He leapt sideways from the game agent's darting sword, trying to draw him round so he could grab one of the fallen weapons. Even the Kroot's frigging billhook would do. The game agent was smarter than that. He kept pressing in, driving Nail towards the gallery wall. Priest was looking back at Ravener stroke Mathuin. The whirling stave sword was slowly getting the better of the battle-plated man's falchion. A swing, a strike, a brittle flare of sparks.
"For throne's sake, Ravener," she yelled. "We have to—"
Ravener suddenly staggered.
Was he hit?
She hadn't seen him take a hit. Why was he— Ravener fell flat on his face. Horrified, Priest couldn't rid her mind of the simple cliché, like a puppet when the strings are cut. The game agent aimed the tip of his hook sword at Nail.
"Time to surrender, I believe," he said. "Oh, I can go all night," Nail panted. "I'm sure, but can they?"
Nail looked around. Ravenna was face down on the ground, still, dead. The man in the polished blue battleplate now had his falchion to Priest's throat. At last she had stopped yelling. Her eyes were wide, blinking, wet with frightened tears, staring right at him.
"Fine," said Nail, raising his hands. "Fine!"